True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
I think when we first started the investigation, people assumed that it would have been a passion, spur-of-the-moment killing, and yet we discovered that it was in fact a premeditated killing, that Capano had spent months in advance planning. So that was an unexpected result. The cooler was another surprise, and I, to this day, believe really was the result of some kind of divine intervention. The cooler was the ultimate corroboration of Jerry, Capano's brother. Jerry had told us that they took the body, Anne-Marie's body, out to sea in a cooler, and that Capano dumped her body into the ocean. They then ripped the lid off the cooler, which would not sink, and they threw it out to sea. Now, this was not before Jerry had shot a hole in the cooler, hoping that the hole would cause it to sink, which it didn't. The day after Capano was arrested, we received a call at FBI from a man who said, you know, I read about this in the paper, and this is an odd thing, but around the time in question, my friend and I found a cooler many miles off the coast of Indian River Inlet. So we immediately went and got the cooler, and that served to just, I think, make it impossible for the defense to dispute what Jerry said. It does sadden me that the case is remembered as the Capano case, because the real tragedy here is that the world lost a very beautiful, loving person and who had a very close family and who never got to bury her and, you know, never had the full closure that comes with a burial, and obviously lost somebody they loved too soon and because somebody was a very evil individual.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
And today we're talking about the murder of Anne-Marie Fahey. Anne-Marie was a beautiful, ambitious secretary to the governor of Delaware when she disappeared back in 1996. Anne-Marie had been having an affair with a married man, an affair that she had ended. But her ex-lover, Thomas Capano, was not a man who took no for an answer. In fact, he'd been stalking Anne-Marie for weeks. Thomas Capano, a powerful attorney and the father of four, denied knowing anything about Anne-Marie's disappearance. But when the truth came to the surface, Anne-Marie's loved ones were devastated, and Capano's image was destroyed. He was exposed as a womanizer, a man with a temper, and ultimately a cold-blooded murderer. Anne-Marie had defied Capano when she broke things off with him to pursue a better life with a new love interest, and he wanted to keep her to himself. When Anne-Marie had the confidence to leave, he murdered her, enlisting the help of his brother to dispose of her body. So join us at the quiet end today for Out to Sea, a fascinating and really sad story about the murder of Anne-Marie Fahey.
So I've been waiting to do a case in Delaware where this occurred, just because I wanted to review a beer from Dogfish Head, one of my favorite breweries. So what I chose for this one was 120-minute IPA. This is an Imperial IPA, and it's pretty boozy. It's anywhere from 15 to 20% alcohol by volume, depending on which year you get it or when it's made.
So what do the minutes mean?
That's how long it's boiled when they're making it. So the longer the boil, the hoppier it can get.
You know what I thought, and this is really stupid. I thought the minutes were how long you had to stay in the bar or wherever before you could drive. Because it seems like the more minutes, the more alcohol they have.
True.
That's true. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, they make a 60-minute, which is a very popular beer, very good beer, 90-minute, and 120-minute.
And the 120 is the strongest.
120 is the strongest.
So you shouldn't drive for 120 minutes.
probably not.
Okay.
And I have to tell you up front, this is not one of my favorite Dogfish Head beers, but I chose it just because it's kind of iconic. But it's a kind of a boozy mess of a beer. It's a pretty beer. It's got a nice reddish-orange color and a little bit of a head, medium-sized white head. When you stick your nose in there, you get alcohol and you get some fruit. And the fruit turns out to be some tropical fruit and some citrus fruit. And still a ton of alcohol. It's a very thick, rich, kind of chewy beer. We've used that adjective before.
Certainly.
But to me, it's just too much booze in there.
Okay. So the taste isn't your favorite?
It's not my favorite. Okay. So when we do another Delaware case, I will probably pick a Dogfish Head beer, but I'll pick a different one.
Great. All right. Well, let's open it up.
We'll open it. I think if we share it with one or two other people, 3 to 4 ounces per person, that'd be plenty.
Follow me down to the quiet end, and we're going to spend at least 120 minutes down here doing our episode.
Okay. So Anne-Marie Fahey was stronger than most people. Stronger than most people had ever realized, because she was a pretty private person. She had a difficult, even miserable childhood. Her mother died when she was just 9 years old. Her father, Robert, was an alcoholic who didn't cope well with the loss of his wife. So Anne-Marie's care and financial support were provided by her 5 older siblings. But she didn't want to be looked down upon with sympathy. She didn't want anyone to feel sorry for her because she didn't have a mother, a nice house, or even new clothes. She developed a resilient personality that hid her insecurities and her emotional pain. As if there's anything about her life, it was unpredictable. As children of an alcoholic, she and her siblings waited for the next problem to happen, and they planned their own survival. They blocked out their father's angry outbursts when he was drunk, and never let friends see how bad things were at home.
Yeah, it's interesting that most of her childhood friends had no idea how terrible things were at home.
Not a clue. Yeah, because she put on a good front.
Absolutely. I mean, they were often without heat or even lights because the electricity would be turned off when their father wouldn't pay the bill. And their father was on Social Security, but he used his checks often to buy liquor instead of paying the bills. When there were no lights on at home, Anne-Marie would study at the library or she'd go over to a friend's house. And there was often no hot water at home, or sometimes no water at all. And that could go on for months, even close to a year once. And once their telephone was cut off for a year. So Anne-Marie would take her hot showers at school after gym class and never told friends what she was going through. In fact, she worked really hard to seem just like the other girls her age. It was important to her not to be pitied or looked down upon.
Absolutely.
Now, when she was 12, her father remarried, so things looked up for a little bit. His new wife had a son and a daughter from her first marriage. And Anne-Marie was really happy to have a stepmom. It was nice for her to have more of a normal home life with an adult woman around who took care of meals and cleaning, and things were more structured. But this second marriage only lasted a few months. It turned out her dad had lied to this woman, and the woman was under false pretenses, and eventually left. Then the house reverted quickly back to the way it had been, with everyone just fending for themselves, no feeling of security, people just ate haphazard, you know, no family meals. Just really a tough life for a kid.
It was. But the kids all looked after one another.
Yes.
They took care of one another.
Her older siblings really did a lot for her.
Yeah.
And for each other, I'm sure.
So when Anne-Marie was 14, her home was foreclosed. Literally. She had done a lot of babysitting. And one of the families that she had worked with invited her to come live with them. Her father was moving to a small apartment in the city. She talked the offer over with her grandmother, and they agreed she should accept the offer. Now, as grateful as she was to have a place to live in and remain in the same school district, Anne-Marie felt like an outsider living on charity.
Which I could see that.
Sure.
The family did try and, you know, let her be more at ease. They did consider her to be one of them. But she felt guilty about eating their food because she couldn't contribute any money to buy groceries. And this is when Anne Marie became obsessive about being clean and being less of a bother. She kept her room spotless so that no one would ever have to clean up after her. So she often left the table while she was still hungry because she didn't want to eat too much food. And this was partly where her anorexia began, because she did suffer with an eating disorder. Part of it was because her dad called her fat when she was little, but part of it was also this.
Yeah.
Among probably other things as well.
I'm sure.
But she had 1 year of high school left when her brothers Kevin and Robert told her that she could come and live with them. They'd bought a house together, and they had a bedroom set up for Anne Marie. So for her senior year in high school, she had a pretty stable home life. And when she graduated in 1984, Anne Marie had been accepted at Wesley College in Dover. And even with student loans, though, she had to work a lot. She worked as a waitress while taking classes, but managed to do very well with both. Her struggle to make ends meet was a sharp contrast from Tom Capano's life. The Capanos had a large home with access to their own private beach. Tom's father, Lou, had built up most of North Wilmington, and he honored his family by naming streets after them. There were streets named Thomas, Lewis, Joseph, and there were cul-de-sacs named Gerard Circle and Capano Court. So Lou was a self-made man, but Tom certainly wasn't. Lou had given his family a mansion in the city and on the Atlantic Ocean, but he always regretted that he hadn't gone to college, so it was important for him for his sons to go to college. And Thomas was the scholar, so Lou was the proudest of him. Tom graduated from Archmere in 1967 and had been accepted at Boston College. He met his wife Kay at Boston College and went on to law school. So they dated through college and they got married in 1972.
Now, when they graduated, Kay found a job as a public health nurse. And she didn't have to work because Tom's parents supported them and paid Tom's tuition. But she wanted to work as a nurse. Then when Tom graduated law school in 1974, he and Kay moved back to Wilmington. He studied that summer for the Delaware bar exam, and they lived in a townhouse near Newark, Delaware, in the Cavalier Country Club complex that his brothers Louie, Joey, and their father had built while Tom was away at law school. Kay loved Tom, and she waited on him hand and foot, just as his mother had always done. That's a good recipe, isn't it?
That's the kind of family it was, you know. The mother stayed home, and these boys were really taken care of and pampered.
They were.
It was a pretty easy life. And Tom was smart, so he was able to really excel.
Mm-hmm. Well, the brothers did well, too. They stuck with their father in the construction business, so.
Right, but they weren't as scholarly, especially the youngest. He was kind of a ne'er-do-well.
That's putting it mildly.
Yeah.
So after his apprenticeship in a law firm, Tom's first real job as a lawyer was with the public defender's office. He switched from working as a defense attorney to being a prosecutor, and was the prosecuting attorney for the Delaware Attorney General's office working in Wilmington. In the 1980s, Kay and Tom had 4 kids.
They did, and they were able to afford all this, and it really didn't matter what his income was, because his father was just so happy that he had gone through college and done well and was a lawyer. He was so proud. He would still pay a lot of their bills for them.
Yeah, the father was very generous to not just Tom, but all his kids.
Well, sure. Yes. But, I mean, Tom had it pretty easy.
He did.
He could study for the bar without worrying about paying bills.
Yeah. And he had a wife who worked.
Yes.
Who didn't have to, but liked to work, and she brought in some income.
Absolutely. But Tom met Anne Marie later on when she began working at the governor's office. She was the governor's scheduling secretary. She was 28 years old, smart, and really pretty. And even though Tom was married and had been having an affair for over 10 years with a colleague's wife, Debbie McIntyre, he was immediately interested in Anne Marie, which isn't unusual. He had a lot of affairs. It's believed that he was involved with at least 8 women during his marriage to Kay.
A player.
So Anne Marie's close friend, Jill Morrison, was with Anne Marie when she first met Tom Capano. That was in April of 1993. It was at a fundraiser for the Women's Democratic Club, and there were about 150 people there. Kay Capano had actually bought the ticket, but she wasn't able to attend, so she'd sent Tom to represent the family. Tom was 43 at this time. He was very charming, and he talked to Anne Marie and Jill as if they were the only people there, which was really flattering because he was an important person in town and in the Democratic Party in Wilmington. His law position brought him to the governor's office in the state building occasionally, and after that night, he would often stop by Anne Marie's desk to talk to her. So he definitely liked her and was trying to get into a relationship with her. And she was definitely flattered.
Well, sure.
She was an insecure woman.
He's a powerful guy.
Right.
So Jill Morrison, Anne Marie's friend, she was aware that Anne Marie had lunch with Tom every once in a while. And this was in the late spring and summer of 1993. And she didn't think it was anything more than a friendship between the two of them. But that fall, Anne Marie told Jill that she was going out to dinner with Tom. And to Jill, this was a lot different. Going out to dinner with a man seemed more like a date than just having lunch during a work day.
I think me personally, I would have been suspicious from the lunches as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's not...
You know, because there isn't any reason
right
for them to be having lunch together.
Not really. I guess he kind of pretended he was kind of a mentor to her, but not really.
Yeah.
They didn't have any business in common that they needed to talk about.
No.
But so, after they had dinner that night, the next day, Jill asked Anne Marie how her dinner date had gone, and she admitted to her that Tom and she had kissed. So, things were happening. Although, you know, Anne Marie was very private and didn't share much more than that.
We kissed.
But she did refer to him as Tommy, which is kind of a red flag to me. She always called him that, and it became obvious after a while that these two were in a romantic relationship. When they met, it seemed to her like it was almost perfect. And she wrote in her diary, "I'm madly in love with him." They began an affair, even though she was uncomfortable with the fact that he was married, and she did feel a lot of guilt about that. She was a Catholic girl. Yes.
I mean, and she was a really staunch Catholic.
And she was hard on herself about everything anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
But dating a married man, that is anathema to Catholics.
But she did it, so she must have really had strong feelings for him at that point.
Well, sure. The feelings overcame the reservations she had.
They did. But eventually, she tried to get out of it. In late 1995, she met and fell in love with a single guy, Michael Scanlon, and began trying to distance herself more and more from Tom. And her sister and friends would say she really seemed like she was in love with Michael, and she was thinking she could actually have a life with him, kids, a home, all that jazz. According to Anne Marie's psychiatrist, she was actually trying to let Capano down easy, and she continued to talk to him and answer his calls, hoping to just be friends.
Yeah, but he didn't take her efforts to separate from him very well.
No, this guy had a huge ego.
He did.
Yeah.
So it's impossible for a woman to not want him.
In his mind, sure.
Right?
It's not something he could easily accept.
So he started making harassing phone calls to Anne Marie. And according to her psychiatrist, he also began showing up at her house and demanding that she return his gifts that he'd given her. And she got to be afraid of him. She became afraid so much that she thought he might kill her.
Yeah, he had quite a temper. So on Thursday, June 27th, 1996, Anne Marie agreed to have dinner with Tom Capano in Philadelphia. And we think she was just trying to kind of placate him and be friends. Although nobody knows for sure because, like I said, she was very private. The waitress who served them would say that they didn't look like a happy couple. And 2 hours after dinner, they'd left and returned to Capano's home. Anne Marie was never seen again after this. And her family would report her missing 3 days later, June 30th. Family and friends gathered in Anne Marie's apartment and tried to think of reasons why she'd been out of touch, hoping that she was all right and she'd be coming home soon. But they knew better than this pretty early on, and they were all terrified. Anne Marie was not the type of person that was going to take off without telling them. And if she could see how frightened they all were, she would have been really sorry and apologized. She was the type of person who never wanted to be any trouble, never wanted to worry anyone.
Now, Anne Marie's older brother, Robert, lived about a half hour outside of Wilmington. He and his wife, Susan, had expected Anne Marie and her boyfriend, Mike Scanlon, to join them for an early dinner. But they never arrived, they never called. When Susan called Anne Marie, all she got was the answering machine. And Mike Scanlon was concerned, too. He had believed that Anne Marie had been home earlier in the day because he'd driven by her apartment and her car was there. But she hadn't returned any of his calls. Then at 9 o'clock, Mike called Anne's older sister, Kathleen. As soon as he told her the story about having plans and that Anne Marie didn't show, Kathleen knew that something was terribly wrong. Anne Marie was so happy with Michael and she saw him as her future husband. She would never stand him up.
Yeah, so Kathleen told Mike she'd call him right back, and then she called a co-worker at the governor's office to see if she knew of any plans Anne Marie may have had. And the co-worker was worried too, because there was nothing. So she called Anne Marie's close friend Jill Morrison. So a friend, Ginny and Jill, lived closer to Anne Marie's apartment than Kathleen did, so they volunteered to go over and check on her. When no one answered the door at Anne Marie's apartment, they asked her landlady if she had seen her. And the landlady hadn't seen Anne Marie for over a day. But she said that wasn't really unusual because Anne Marie was generally pretty quiet. She wasn't having parties or making a lot of noise, you know?
Yeah, she was pretty much a model tenant.
Absolutely. But this was Saturday night, and Anne Marie's door was locked with the deadbolt. And the landlady opened that door with the key and called for Anne Marie, but there was no answer. So she walked through the living room to the kitchen, looked in the bedroom. Nobody's there. Jill and Ginny called Kathleen back with an update. Anne Marie wasn't there, but her car was parked outside. So Kathleen called the Wilmington Police Department to report her as a missing person right away, which could have been seen as kind of alarmist. But she felt like she knew her sister pretty well. And the detective on duty told her she'd have to come down to the station or call him back from her sister's apartment. So Kathleen called Mike Scanlon back, and he went to pick her up and bring her over to Anne Marie's place. Because both of them, by this time, are very nervous that something's not right, that something's happened to her. So Kathleen and Mike arrived at the apartment, and they learned that Anne Marie had not been seen in over 48 hours. Her bed was all white with a comforter of white-on-white puffed hearts, but it wasn't made the way that she usually made it. So Kathleen didn't know if it was her imagination, but it looked like someone had yanked the comforter up and then pushed it down, leaving dents in the bed. The little TV that Kathleen's husband Patrick had given Anne Marie for Christmas was in its usual spot, and there was a new air conditioner there, too, and that had been left on, which is not something Anne Marie normally did. She was frugal.
Yeah.
I mean, after that childhood, you would be, right?
You sure would.
You would. So Anne Marie didn't own a lot of things. Her furniture was secondhand, or she had some of that cheap stuff that you buy at Walmart or IKEA and you have to assemble it yourself. But she decorated the apartment kind of cute. She had, you know, pictures of family decorating the walls. And she still had her childhood stuffed animals in her bedroom.
You know, one thing they did find was in the kitchen. Anne Marie always kept her kitchen spotless. But now the entire kitchen stunk of rotting food. Counter was littered with fruit and vegetables that were overripe and mushy. Then there was a garbage can with its plastic liner pulled up. That was next to the kitchen table. And it also was full of decaying food. Now, Mike knew that Anne Marie hated to keep any garbage in her apartment. He remembered when he picked her up for dates, she would always carry a neat bag of garbage to put in the outside receptacles. So it wasn't going to stay in her house.
No, super tidy. But the most frightening thing probably was that they found Anne Marie's purse with her wallet and all of her credit cards there. There was about $40 in cash in the wallet, and the date book that she used to keep track of all of her appointments was there also. But her keys were gone. The keys to the car and the apartment were gone. So this is all not making a lot of sense.
It isn't. The fact that her Volkswagen Jetta was parked in its usual spot across the street meant that she wasn't on her own. She had to be with someone else. And it was impossible that she had left of her own volition without telling any of the people who loved her. Kathleen knew that Anne Marie was in love with Mike, and she would have returned his calls. And she would have called Kathleen back, too. But she hadn't returned any calls since Thursday afternoon.
So on Sunday, June 30th, about 12:15 a.m., so a little after midnight, Kathleen called the police again to report Anne Marie missing. And then she decided she was going to have to go ahead and look through her sister's personal things. And Kathleen found notes and cards in Anne Marie's drawers. But they weren't all from Mike Scanlon. Anne Marie was sentimental, and she had saved mementos from her dates with Mike in her top dresser drawer. You know, like movie tickets, notes he'd written, or things like that. But then in the top drawer of a desk in the living room, Kathleen found an envelope that read Anne Marie Fahey and personal and confidential. So Kathleen opened that envelope and she found a long letter from a man. And the letter ended, "All I want to do is make you happy and be with you. I love you." And the letter wasn't signed, but there were other letters and notes in the envelope, and none of them were signed. But they were all on the letterhead of the law firm, Saul, Ewing, Remick, and Saul, from the desk of Thomas J. Capano. So she knew. These notes were from Tom Capano, which was pretty shocking to her. She had no knowledge of any personal relationship between these two.
None whatsoever. She did remember the previous fall, when her friend Bud Friel, who was a Wilmington City Councilman, had mentioned to her that he'd heard a rumor Anne Marie and Tom were dating. But Anne Marie never talked about Capano to her family. And it was difficult for Kathleen to believe that she could be holding back such a big secret from her sister and her brothers.
But I think she was doing it out of shame. She was ashamed that she'd been seeing this
guy. Absolutely, yeah.
Now, Kathleen didn't really know Tom Capano, but she did know of him like everyone did. Everyone in Wilmington knew who he was and who the family was. They were very well known, and Tom was powerful, wealthy, and she knew he was married as well. It was after midnight when Colonel Alan Ellingsworth, the superintendent of the Delaware State Police, was notified that one of Governor Carpo's secretaries, Anne Marie, was missing. And the investigators listened as Kathleen, Mike Scanlon, and Jill Morrison told them about their last contact with Anne Marie. No one had actually seen or talked to her since Thursday afternoon. And they knew that Anne Marie was dealing with some depression and an eating disorder and seeing a psychiatrist. But her family and friends believed she was doing really well when she disappeared. There was no sign of forceful entry or no signs of a struggle in the apartment. But of course, many things were concerning. For one thing, she hadn't checked her answering machine in 3 days. And the apartment was messy, which was completely unlike her. I mean, like we said, she was really known as a neat freak. Friends actually joked with her and called her Anal Annie. So, I mean, her apartment was almost like a sterile field.
Yeah.
And her diary contained the secret of her relationship with Tom Capano. Investigators figured out that Anne Marie had been in an affair with him for 3 years. So this was pretty shocking because he was a prominent man in the state of Delaware, and he had recently left his wife, and his 4 daughters were in their teens. So Tom had 3 brothers. Lewis was a contractor and had been involved in some financial scandals. And his youngest brother, Jerry, was the kind of black sheep who'd been into drugs and in some trouble with the law more than once. But Tom, he was the golden boy. So Anne Marie's diary had a final entry that was pretty alarming, and it read, "I have finally brought closure to Tom Capano. What a controlling, manipulative, insecure, jealous maniac. Now that I look back on that aspect of my life, I realize just how vulnerable I had become."
So Anne Marie and Mike Scanlon had been together through the spring of 1996. They went to weddings, parties, and they spent time with their family. So they were a couple.
Yeah, they were a real couple. And she seemed pretty happy.
She didn't worry that Mike wouldn't call her when he said he would. He was a reliable person, and he gave her a feeling of security and peace.
Which I don't think she'd really ever had. You know, maybe from her siblings, but certainly not from her parents. Her mom died, and her dad was just kind of a mess.
Yeah, for sure.
She had this long relationship with Capano, and I think she'd had other relationships earlier that were kind of crappy.
Yeah. But all didn't go well, because Tom Capano reappeared in her life that spring. There was a string of emails between his office and the governor's office that began on April 24th, more from Tom than from Anne Marie. Now, he told Anne Marie that Katie, his second daughter, was going to have brain surgery, and she felt sorry for him.
And that's why he did it. He was trying to get her sympathy.
He's going to do whatever it takes.
Right.
He told Anne Marie that he needed her, just as a friend, to get through his daughter's illness. And he asked her if she would go to the hospital with him to see her. Anne Marie said she couldn't go to the hospital with him, and she felt angry and manipulated that he would even ask her.
Well, yes, because this girl has a mother who's going to be at the hospital. So do you really think it would have been appropriate for Anne Marie to be there?
Nope.
I mean, she'd run into Tom's daughters a few times, and Tom had introduced her as a friend, but she didn't really know them. She didn't know them well enough to be visiting in the hospital. And certainly his ex-wife Kay would have known what was up with that. But if Anne Marie had gone to see Katie, it would have been exposed that Tom was lying anyway. Katie wasn't having brain surgery. She'd actually just fainted during one of her basketball games. Of course, Anne Marie didn't know that, but she was suspicious. I mean, she was insecure, but she was not stupid. She was a smart woman. So she wondered if Tom was just using a story about his daughter to get to her. And of course he was.
Sure. But the tactic did work.
To a certain extent it did, yeah.
Yeah, he and Anne Marie started talking again. Anne Marie always hoped that she and Tom could be friends. It had been months since she'd had a physical relationship with him, and she never intended to have sex with him again. But Tom began to call her more and more, and to ask questions about her health, her financial situation, her friends, and her life in general. He knew she was serious about Mike Scanlon, and she had even told him about some of their dates.
Yeah, he tried to act kind of like an older brother to her, even though that certainly wasn't where his mind was at.
No. The interesting thing, though, is even as he was trying to win Anne Marie back, he never ended his relationship with one of his first affairs, Debbie McIntyre.
No, and I think he was involved with a third woman as well during that time.
He was.
So it wasn't about love or wanting to be with Anne Marie. It was just a possessive ego thing.
It was.
He wasn't going to let her break up with him and leave him.
No. Well, Debbie divorced her husband because she believed that she and Tom would eventually be married.
Yeah, she was just a doormat for him.
Yeah.
And she wasn't a stupid woman, but there was just something about him. He had really charmed her. But Mike didn't know about Tom at all. And most of Anne Marie's friends still didn't know that she was talking to Tom. They were all relieved that she'd moved on, actually, and was seeing someone nice. But Tom's emails to her seemed friendly and casual, and she thought she was dealing well with him, that things were going to be okay. He asked her repeatedly to go out to dinner with him at a restaurant where they had once dined when they were a couple, and she'd repeatedly refused. But she gave in and agreed to have dinner with him on June 27th. The last day she was seen.
Capanna was interviewed by police when Anne Marie was reported missing. In a short interview, he admitted that he and Anne Marie had dined at Ristorante Panorama in Philadelphia and had returned together to his house in Wilmington. Capanna said he drove her home that night, and that was all he knew. He hadn't been in touch with her since then. Now, he then went out and hired a team of lawyers and refused to speak anymore with the police. He said he just wanted to avoid a scandal. So after a month of investigating, Capanna was the primary suspect in her disappearance, and police didn't believe that she was still alive.
But Tom Capanna was very well connected. He not only had friends in the governor's office, but in the police department and the city council. And God knows where else. I mean, he was very prominent. He was a mover and a shaker. And police had no body. They had no weapon, and of course no confession. So without some evidence, they really couldn't get a search warrant for his home, and that's what they felt they really needed, because they felt pretty sure he was involved. He was the last one to see her. So while searching Capanna's financial records, police found a receipt from Wallpaper Warehouse, and this would really be the evidence that kind of broke through and got them somewhere.
Yeah, got them started in the right direction, didn't it?
Yeah, it helped them to get a search warrant. Because Tom was living in a rented home, remember he'd left his wife, and he wasn't a do-it-yourself type of guy. So the Wallpaper Warehouse receipt really caught their attention. And when a detective called the phone number on the receipt, a person answered and said, "Airbase Carpet." So that was a big aha moment. It turned out that Airbase Carpet was a subsidiary of Wallpaper Warehouse. So, of course, this led them to believe that Capano had killed Anne Marie and had gotten rid of the carpet because it had blood on it, possibly even rolled her body up in it and gotten rid of her. So they interviewed people, including Tom's housekeeper, who told them, yeah, the furniture and the carpet had been replaced and rearranged. So the new rug was confiscated, but no blood was found on that. But they did find 4 tiny spots of blood on the baseboards. But you know what? Anne Marie was so freaking clean that they didn't find any DNA samples in her apartment that they could use to compare the blood to. So there was a delay in identifying that blood.
There was. But nevertheless, the investigation was gaining momentum. Tips were coming in. One of the most promising tips came from an employee of the Capano & Sons Construction Company. On July 1st, employee Shaw Taylor had been given a message from a fellow employee telling him to have the dumpsters emptied at the family firm. Taylor remarked to Louis's son, Louis Capano III, that it wasn't the regular day for emptying the dumpsters, and that they were less than half full. Louis number 3 called his father to ask him why, and Louis II told him to get off his cell phone immediately and not to discuss it over the phone. So following orders, the waste disposal company was called and the dumpsters were emptied. When the investigative team heard about this, their first thought was that Anne Marie's body might have been in one of those dumpsters. And if not her body, then maybe the missing couch and carpet from the living room at Tom's house.
Well, that makes sense. I could see that.
Yeah, because there's no reason for the company to come and empty the dumpsters.
Well, no. And if your girlfriend, for lack of a better word, goes missing, and then you're getting new carpet and furniture, and your brother's emptying the dumpsters prematurely, these are all bad signs.
All good circumstantial evidence that can add up.
Absolutely, and it is piling up.
We're going to take a break here. Our sponsor is calling.
Our sponsor is Madison Reed, one of my favorite beauty products. You can take coloring your hair at home to the next level by using Madison Reed, because Madison Reed gives you gorgeous, professional hair color that they deliver to your door for less than $25. Madison Reed hair color is really one of a kind, because it's multidimensional, and they give you your choice of over 45 multi-tonal shades. And each of these shades have been developed by master colorists who really know how to blend the nuances of cool, warm, light, and dark. Many of our listeners have written to me to tell me that Madison Reed hair color has improved their lives. I totally get it. It's a small thing, but it can make life better. Because Madison Reed delivers gray coverage, and it gives you natural-looking hair color. Plus, they deliver it to your door on the schedule that you want. So now I'm free from the long salon visits and I'm saving money while my hair looks and feels better than ever. It's strong, it's soft, and very natural looking. So it gives me one less thing to worry about, and that's always good. So I'm happy to recommend Madison Reed to our listeners. It's affordable, it's convenient, and it's very high quality. We're busy women, so don't we deserve gorgeous professional hair color delivered to our doors on our schedule for less than $25? Of course we do. You can find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. And True Crime Brewery listeners get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit by using our code BREWERY. That's code BREWERY at madison-reed.com.
So after getting the evidence of the dumpsters being emptied early, police searched the landfill. And we've talked about what a disgusting, horrible job that is.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
And in this case, they found absolutely nothing to help with the case.
And this was July, so yeah, it was hot too.
Particularly.
Really gruesome. Heinous. Mm-hmm.
But the police continued to interview people who knew Anne Marie and Tom. There was a friend of Anne Marie's who told investigators that just 6 to 8 weeks before she vanished, Tom had climbed up the fire escape of her building and broke into her apartment. He had been yelling at her in a rage and started taking back various gifts he had given her. And another friend told investigators that Tom Capano had once grabbed Anne Marie by the neck, called her a slut and a bitch. They also interviewed Jill Morrison and heard some scary details about Anne Marie's struggle to get away from Tom before she disappeared.
Right, and I always think that a man that will call a woman those names will do just about anything, because that's really heinous.
It's certainly not a complimentary term, is it?
Well, no, and it just makes me feel like they weren't raised right or they don't have the right attitude about women. It's just beyond disrespectful. It's a violent thing to call someone those names. It just, to me, I would connect that to someone who would hurt a woman physically.
I think so.
So about a year and a half go by after Anne Marie went missing, and a grand jury was impaneled on the case. Debbie McIntyre, one of Tom's other lovers, was one of the people brought in to be questioned, and her testimony broke open the case for murder by bringing up a possible murder weapon. So back in the early spring of 96, Tom had called to ask Debbie to do something very important for him, but he wouldn't tell her what it was. In April, Tom asked her again, and this time he specified what it was. He wanted her to buy a gun for him. "Somebody's trying to extort me," is what he told her. "I'm not going to use it. I just want to threaten this person, and then I'll give it back to you." So Debbie told him she didn't want a gun in her house. But Tom said, "Well, you know, I'm really concerned about your safety, too. You're a single mother now living alone," because she'd left her husband for Tom. So he pointed out that crime rates were up and it would really be wise for her to have a gun around just in case.
Yeah, now he never said why he couldn't buy the gun himself. And he couldn't give her any details about who was extorting him. But Debbie agreed to do it. Tom gave her detailed instructions. He told her to go to the Sports Authority, go to the hunting section. Now she did. When she asked for a gun, Debbie made the mistake of saying she was buying it for a friend. Now, the salesman quickly told her that was against the law. You cannot transfer a firearm to someone else. So she was very embarrassed and she left the store without buying a gun.
Yeah, so about another month passed and Tom took Debbie to Washington, D.C. for a lawyer's conference. And shortly after they came home, he asked her again to buy a gun for him. And the day after that, which was May 13th, Tom picked Debbie up and drove her to a little gun store, Miller's, and he waited in the car and sent her in. She was really nervous, but this time she knew what to say, and for some reason it was important to her to please Tom. So she asked to see a small weapon that would be suitable for self-defense, and the salesman showed her a few guns. She ended up choosing a Beretta 22 caliber revolver, so she paid for it and she also bought a box of bullets. Then when she got back to Tom's car, she told him how concerned she was about breaking the law by giving him the gun. But he laughed and told her not to be ridiculous. So Tom put the gun and the bullets behind the back seat of his Cherokee, and he took Debbie out to a nearby restaurant for lunch, kind of like you'd reward a child for doing something you wanted them to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. But Debbie never saw that gun again. And for a long time, she was really worried because she had broken the law. But she put it out of her mind. You know, I'm sure Tom helped her with that. And Debbie didn't tell the police at first that she and Tom were lovers. But she remembered Thursday, June 27th. In the morning, she and Tom had their usual phone conversation between 9:30 and 10:30, and she didn't hear from him again until 5 p.m., when he told her he had a business meeting in Philadelphia. Now we know that he was taking Anne Marie out to dinner, actually.
That was the dinner date.
So she called Tom about 10:30 that night, but he wasn't home, and she left a message. Tom called her back between 11:30 and 12:30, and she said he sounded tired, but pretty normal. Nothing seemed really different about him. Debbie told the three investigators that she hadn't known Tom had a dinner date with the woman who went missing, Anne Marie, until the following Tuesday when Tom told her about it. But it was clear that she was supportive of Tom, and they found out they were lovers. But Debbie said she was certain that he had nothing to do with Anne Marie's disappearance. He just wasn't that type of guy.
He couldn't be.
No.
Now, Debbie also said that Tom told her he'd spilled some wine on the carpet and the sofa. That's why he had replaced them. Now, she also mentioned seeing a small hole in the wall, which Tom said a picture had fallen down, causing the hole.
The investigators already knew about that hole in the wall, and they'd examined it, but found nothing. It was just a hole in the wall behind a picture, and beneath the plaster, the bricks didn't have any nicks in them. And despite the gun, the detectives thought, well, maybe he just killed her with his bare hands. She'd probably been beaten and strangled, but she had definitely bled a lot either way. Enough so that he had to get rid of the furniture and the carpet. But of course, no one would really know what had happened. It was just the two of them there.
Right.
But we know that she died a violent death, either by the gun or by beating.
And on the day after Anne Marie had vanished, Tom Capano apparently was with his brother Jerry for a good portion of that day. Now, Jerry had good reason to help out his older brother, because Tom had bailed him out of trouble many, many times. You remember we were talking about Jerry was into drugs, as you said, was the black sheep of the family.
Right. He'd gotten in some trouble, and Tom was always helping him out.
Tom was a good big brother.
But Jerry's name also stood out in a timeline that Tom had written for himself for Friday, June 28, 1996. Police had found this timeline tucked away in Tom's office. Jerry's name appeared 5 times on that piece of paper. At 6:30, between 10:30 and 11, at 12:30, between 12:30 and 1, and at 3 p.m. And then for 9:15 to 10:30, Tom had written drive to SH. And police knew that SH was probably, almost certainly, Stone Harbor. Jerry had a house and a boat there, and he was the one who spent the most time at Stone Harbor. Their brother Joey wasn't mentioned in Tom's notes at all, but investigators suspected that Jerry and Louie, the other two brothers, were protecting Tom. So they decided they'd put some pressure on Jerry and Louie. And they weren't going to talk without an incentive, though. Louie had had trouble in the past with illegal campaign contributions and some bribery of public officials. He was a multimillionaire and a smart construction entrepreneur, but he had been known to pay people off when it came to zoning and building permits, so he had some skeletons in his closet. Tom's connections and knowledge of the law allowed Louie to walk away unscathed from these things, but he still had some anxiety about the government's interest in his business dealings. Louie was called before the grand jury, and he was asked a lot of questions. Both his business and his personal life suffered. His wife and his son, both innocent victims here, really, had become involved in the aftermath of Anne Marie's disappearance. And if Louie protected Tom, he was really putting his whole immediate family at risk with this.
He was. And then Jerry Capano's activities were even more troublesome. Some of his closest friends had prison records, and Jerry collected just a crazy number of guns. When he wasn't drinking or on drugs, Jerry was a likable enough guy. Not as smart as Tom, though. He was the weakest member of the family, and police believed he knew something about Anne Marie's disappearance.
Yeah, so they really set their sights on him.
They did. So the detectives contacted the ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency, to help. They looked at Jerry's activities and watched him ready to apply pressure if he broke any laws.
Which they pretty much knew he would.
Well, yeah, and they're just waiting for him to screw up, because that's his pattern.
Right. So it was Wednesday, October 8th of 97, when a federal search warrant was executed at Jerry's house. And the warrant specified that authorities had reason to suspect that they would find evidence of possession of cocaine. Also possession with intent to distribute, and possession of a firearm by a drug user. The ATF agents found 10 shotguns, 4 rifles, 4 revolvers, and 8 illegal explosive devices. Isn't that weird? Why would anyone have that?
He was a collector.
Yes. But they also were able to verify Jerry's possession of drugs. So the search verified that Jerry had broken the law because it's illegal for a drug user to possess guns. Then a week later, the federal agents raided a man named Ed Del Colo's house and found another gun. Del Colo was Jerry's best friend, and he was a convicted felon. And convicted felons aren't allowed to own guns at all, of course. So a check of the serial numbers showed that Jerry had purchased the gun for Ed. So he'd purchased a gun for a felon. He had broken another federal law. So he hadn't only transferred the guns, he'd purchased them. And another suspicious thing was that Jerry had sold his boat shortly after Anne Marie's disappearance, and they found out it was sold without its anchor.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it?
That's a lot of things are adding up.
So old Jerry's looking at 3 or more years in prison. Then the Division of Family Services started an investigation of Jerry and his wife's suitability as parents. Authorities were concerned that their children, both of whom were toddlers, were living surrounded by guns and drugs.
Well, no shit.
Yeah.
That's so scary.
Tom stepped in to help Jerry and said he should consult an attorney, even telling his little brother who to call. Jerry did, and his lawyer suggested that the federal agents were raiding his home just to force him to implicate his brother in a murder investigation.
Sure, but it was definitely working.
It was, wasn't it?
I mean, his immediate family's at risk.
He's in danger of losing his family and going to jail.
Right.
Those are incentives to
Big
come
incentives,
forward.
Yes. So finally, he agreed to tell investigators what he knew. And he seemed to be actually relieved by telling the story. He was in tears. Now, I don't know if the tears were because he was giving up his older brother, you know, admitting to helping him get rid of Anne-Marie's body, or if he was actually upset about Anne-Marie. I think maybe a little of both. I mean, he wasn't a killer. So Jerry said that at 5:45 a.m. on June 28th, the day after Anne-Marie disappeared, Tom had called him and told him someone was trying to blackmail him. He said he might need his boat to take care of it, whatever that was supposed to mean. Then Tom showed up at Jerry's house around 6 a.m. that morning, and he told him that he had killed someone who was threatening his children. So Jerry told police that he had helped his brother take a large cooler containing Fahey's body out to his vacation home, and they'd taken Jerry's 25-foot fishing boat 60 miles off the Atlantic coast to a spot known for having a lot of sharks. And once there, they dumped the cooler that was holding Anne-Marie's body, just threw it overboard.
Yeah, but the cooler wouldn't sink.
Well, no, they don't, right? They're made to float.
Right. So Jerry shot some holes in it with a shotgun, but it still didn't sink. So Jerry's beside himself. He's telling Tom he couldn't believe he had gotten him involved in something so awful. He looked away as Tom removed Anne-Marie's body from the cooler, wrapped it in chains and an anchor, and dropped it overboard. When Tom told Jerry he was done, Jerry turned in time to see Anne-Marie's foot going down into the water. They just let the cooler drift away empty, and they returned to shore. Once they got back to land, Jerry drove Tom back home, where they loaded a couch and a rug with bloodstains into an SUV. These they put into the dumpsters at Louis's construction company, and Louis ordered the dumpsters to be emptied.
So Jerry really put the whole thing together for them.
Yeah, I think they had a pretty good idea of the scenario, but now they've got an eyewitness who's willing to speak to them.
Yeah, I mean, they knew that it was probably Jerry's boat, that it was Louis's dumpsters. They just didn't really know, you know, how he had killed her. But I mean, at this point, that doesn't even really matter because he had killed her. I mean, once Jerry saw the foot, he knew it was a woman. So Jerry was granted immunity from prosecution for this. And when their brother Louis heard about the deal Jerry had made with police, he went to the police and confessed to his part in the cover-up, and he got immunity. So Tom Capano was under 24-hour FBI surveillance, and then he was seen driving to the airport. So it was ordered that he immediately be arrested. He was trying to flee.
Yeah, you got to get him.
Yeah, so only one day after his arrest, a man called the FBI office claiming that his friend, a local fisherman named Ken Chubb, had a cooler similar to one described in the newspaper. And they knew it was the one when they heard that it had holes in it. So the fisherman had found the cooler floating in the ocean, actually only 4 days after Anne-Marie's body had been dumped, so a long time ago. But this was a nice expensive cooler, so the fisherman had kept it and actually bought a replacement lid for it, repaired the holes, and used it. So Ken Chubb kept it in his shed for over a year. So now investigators went and got the cooler. So this was a big piece of evidence for them. The cooler had been tested, and it showed lead residue around the holes, along with some red fabric, believed to probably be from clothing of Anne-Marie, because the Fahys had said that a red outfit was missing from her apartment. But the thing is, all these large coolers have a barcode from the company and the stores that sold them. And one number would signify the brand. It was an Igloo cooler. Another meant that it was the 162-quart model, so pretty large. Also, there was a date code stamped on the bottom of the cooler. So they knew that this cooler had come off the assembly line back in May of 1993. But more importantly, these barcodes on the coolers identified the stores where they were purchased, and that was how they could make the connection that it had been bought by Capano.
Yeah, because when the barcode for this cooler was entered into the computer, a the Sports Authority store in Wilmington, it matched the store's code for a 162-quart Igloo cooler. And the investigators already knew that Tom had purchased an Igloo cooler on April 20th, 2 months before Anne-Marie disappeared.
Yeah, so we don't know if he had planned to buy the cooler for that reason or if it just happened that he had it around. I don't know if he'd been planning all this out for that long.
I'll bet he had.
You think so?
Sure. Why else would he buy a 160-quart cooler?
Well, it was suggested that maybe he bought it as a present for his brother Jerry, but he hadn't given it to him, so I'm not sure. But obviously there was some planning to this. So it was October of 1998 when the murder trial of Tom Capano finally began. And against his attorney's advice, Capano took the stand in his own defense. He thought he could outsmart everybody. This is the kind of guy who always thought he was the smartest guy in the room. And what he did, which is kind of shocking to me, but, you know, prosecutors said they weren't surprised at all. They knew him pretty well. He blamed Debbie McIntyre for killing Anne-Marie. But he said it was an accident when she was in a jealous rage. He said that Debbie had found him and Anne-Marie together, and she tried to commit suicide. He said that he'd tried to get the gun away from her, and in the struggle, Anne-Marie had accidentally been shot and killed. But he was cross-examined for over 4 hours, and that did not go well for him. He ended up losing his temper and had to be dragged from the stand, flailing and yelling.
Quite a scene.
So that didn't make him look good to the jury.
I know. Then the prosecution also brought up a murder case that Capano had prosecuted back in the 70s. They believed that that case had given him a blueprint for covering up the murder of Anne-Marie. And he also had an inmate who revealed that in an attempt to stop Debbie from testifying, Capano had given him detailed diagrams of her home. Capano said he just wanted to scare her. But after that, he did try unsuccessfully to hire a hitman to kill her.
Yeah, and one of the prosecutors had said that Capano tried to take a hit out on him, too.
Well, he wasn't going to go quietly, was he?
No, he was not. So the trial ended in January of 1999. After 3 days of deliberation, the jury convicted Capano of first-degree murder, and they voted 10-2 for the death penalty.
Then in January 2006, 7 years later, the Delaware Supreme Court affirmed Capano's conviction, but reconsidered sentencing because the death penalty was imposed by a non-unanimous jury verdict. So in February of that year, the state abandoned its efforts to seek capital punishment for Capano, opting to sentence him to life without parole.
Yeah, he appealed again in April of 2008, and the U.S. District Court rejected his habeas corpus petition. And he didn't go ahead and appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. He actually got really obese in prison. Like, he just kind of given up, I guess, and just ate himself to death, according to some people. And he was found dead in his jail cell in state prison in 2011. He was 61 years old, and he died of cardiac arrest.
Yes, he had a heart attack.
Yep. His arteries were really bad, I guess. So, there are at least 3 books written about this case. This is a fairly well-known case.
It is. I remember seeing something about this years ago.
Yeah, the whole cooler part I remember seeing in a documentary some time back. But there's the book And Never Let Her Go, Thomas Capano, The Deadly Seducer by Anne Rule. There's another one, The Summer Wind, Thomas Capano and the Murder of Anne-Marie Fahey by George Anastasia. And another one, Fatal Embrace, The Inside Story of the Thomas Capano Anne-Marie Fahey Murder Case by Chris Barish and Peter Meyer. In 2001, there was a television movie made based on Anne Rule's book, and Mark Harmon starred as Tom Capano, which is interesting because Mark Harmon also starred as Ted Bundy back in an old TV movie.
Well, he's good at playing a killer, huh?
I guess. I think now he's in like CSI or something as a detective. So there's also an episode from the year 2000 of the FBI files titled Deadly Obsession. And there's a 2002 episode of 48 Hours. And pretty recently, in 2018, there was an episode of Vanity Fair Confidential titled The Secret of the Summer Wind about this case. So there's plenty to look at if you want to find out more about this case.
Absolutely.
But it's kind of, I mean, if you get rid of the fact that he was a lawyer and all that, it's kind of your typical spurned lover, stalker, domestic violence type of murder.
Yeah, and I guess if his brothers could have remained silent, it would have been a lot more difficult to prosecute him.
Might have been impossible. I mean, he almost got away with murder. A lot of time went by before he was arrested.
Quite a lot.
Yeah. So I guess that's all we have to say about that case.
We're done.
We're done with that. So let's thank Tristan Capel for our music. He always does a great job with that. And Team Tie Grabber's member setup and website is just about finished. I'm hoping it'll be launched by the time this episode airs, because we're recording this a little bit earlier than we usually do, so we can take our grandsons to Universal Studios this weekend. But we'll definitely be notifying our current members as soon as things are up and running. And I'm sure that I'll also put out some announcements on social media, because I'll be super excited. If you have a few minutes to spare, I would just ask again that you leave a review for us on iTunes or wherever you listen, because more positive reviews really help people to find our podcast, and we like that. So it's time to move on to feedback. If you'd like your voicemail played on a future show, you can go to tiegrabber.com and click on Leave a Voicemail. We'd love to hear your comments on cases we've covered or suggestions for cases that you think we should cover. Alternately, you can send us an email at truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com or send us a message on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Another thing you can do is join our True Crime Brewery fan discussions page on Facebook to chat with us and other listeners about past cases, case suggestions, and any current news in the true crime genre. People really share a lot of things on there. It's very informative. So we're just going to play one voicemail today, and then we'll read a few emails.
Okay. The first and only voicemail is from Debbie, and she has a case suggestion.
Hi, Jill and Dick. My name is Debbie. I'm calling from Montreal, Canada. Love your podcast. I fall asleep to you both every single night. Really amazing. Great work. I was going to recommend that you might want to look into a crime that happened in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And I guess there's not a lot of information on it, but you might want to read a book called First Degree by Kayla Hounsell. Really interesting stuff. Med school student, you know, kind of gone bad. Just really weird. Anyway, I think maybe with you know, Dick's expertise and stuff like that, he might be able to, you know, add some, you know, kind of true crime grit onto the whole story. And anyway. Okay, so love you guys. I'm sad that you're in New Mexico, because I thought at some point I'd get to the East Coast and come and see you. But anyway, I hope everything's going well, and you guys do such a great job. Really good job. Thanks.
Well, thanks so much, Debbie. That's really nice. I appreciate that. You know, we do get back up to the East Coast fairly often, so you never know.
You don't. Now, one of our kids went to McGill University in Montreal, and we love that city.
Yes, yeah.
So much fun. And the case, I went and got the book, First Degree, looking it over. It's fascinating. Here's this medical student. He was just getting ready to start his first year of med school.
Mm-hmm.
Never been in any trouble of any kind. And he killed a college guy who also had no records of anything.
Someone that was in his class or no. Someone he knew?
Not sure he even knew that person that well, if at all.
Weird.
Very. Because we've got two clean, likable kids. Something goes wrong. So I'm going to get more into the book, and I think that'd be a viable case to do.
Well, right now we're planning out October, so I've got some openings for you if you decide we should do it.
Good.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So thanks again, Debbie. That's a good case suggestion. So I'm going to read an email from Lydia, and this is a heartbreaking one. We weren't sure if we were going to read it, but it's just her first name, and I think it's worth reading, right?
I think so.
So Lydia writes, I just have to tell you guys this. I just finished listening to the one about the Coleman family, and that's the one that included Joyce Myers. I hate this story, but here's why I decided I had to message you. My husband and I live in the middle of Oklahoma, so we're smack dab in the middle of the Bible Belt. We grew up as Christians, both of us. We met at church, all that. But 11 years ago, our second born child, our first son, passed away. He had an apneic event on December 10th, 2007, and then spent 29 days in the hospital. The doctor called it near SIDS. He said it was due to his severe reflux and things out of our control. It's all still super hard for me. He was on life support for 9 days and then came home on oxygen and a nasogastric tube. It was awful. Anyway, all of the backstory to say that, while we were in the hospital, we were approached by a guy who was involved in Prosperity Gospel. And of course, that's what Joyce Myers is deeply involved in.
Yes.
We trusted him because we knew him really well, and it's insane. They take the Bible that you've read your whole life and they twist it around. It's like an abusive husband. They make it say exactly what you are hoping with all of your heart it will say. For example, the Prosperity Gospel preacher that prayed over me and my very sick baby boy looked in my eyes after he prayed and he said, "He's healed. You just have to believe with all your heart and go home and you'll see." He died 2 weeks later in my arms. I hate the Prosperity Gospel. It's so manipulative. It's gaslighting. It's exploitive. And it is not any gospel I've ever heard. So that's even hard to read. I give her a lot of credit for being able to write it.
Yes, it was, I'm sure, difficult to write.
But these are just assholes who do this to people. And this man should be in prison for saying that to her.
Well, absolutely. And he probably asked for money, too.
Yeah, probably. Well, isn't one thing they say is you give me money and it'll come back to you 50-fold from God as some bullshit like that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're harmful.
So, I agree. I'm going to say that I hate them too, Lydia. I'm totally with you, and I'm so sorry for your loss. Okay, let's read the next one, Dick. You go ahead and read the next one.
I'll read the next one. This is from Linda. She has a comment on the Temple murder and a case suggestion. So she says, "I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for doing the Belinda Lucas Temple murder. Right now, and I don't know if everyone knows this, we did this episode a while ago. We're in the middle of trial number two. I declared the first trial invalid because of improper manipulations by the prosecution.
The prosecution didn't show all their evidence to the defense, but they let him out, too. He's free.
He's been free.
Yeah.
Now, she says, you know this thing could go either way, but guess what? Heather Temple, who was the woman that he was having an affair with while he was married to Belinda.
And married her.
And married her. She's filed for divorce. And it looks like she could be testifying for the prosecution.
Wouldn't that be something?
She's due to testify this week.
Now, oh, so she is testifying.
By the time this episode airs, she'll have testified.
Wow.
So Linda says, if you go to KPRC Channel 2, the NBC website in Houston, they have the most comprehensive coverage at this time. So that's going to be something we'll definitely need to follow up with.
Yes, because we both feel he's guilty.
Oh, I don't think there's any question in my mind.
So it kind of seems like he's been let out on a technicality.
Right. Then her suggestion is to cover the case of Kathleen Fulton Page. I think it's Catherine. It's someone Catherine Page. Anyway, I looked it up. This occurred in 1991. They found this woman had disappeared. I'm not sure they've ever found her body or not. They were pretty sure her husband was involved, but they didn't ever have enough to take him to court with. He did have a civil trial, and he was found liable for her death. Now, the interesting thing about this case is what her father does to keep the case alive. Remember the movie we saw with Frances McDormand?
3 billboards, yeah.
So her father constructs these huge billboards everywhere on the interstates to remind people or inform them that Steve Page was never held criminally liable for his daughter's death. And it might have been the inspiration for 3 billboards in Hibbing, Minnesota, or whatever it is.
Epping, Missouri. Well, yeah, that would make sense.
I think so. Okay. So keep up the great work you do. Mugs up.
All right.
Mugs up to you, Linda.
Sounds good. So you're going to look more into that one?
I'll look more into that one.
When our new website's up, I'm going to create a monthly newsletter. So I think that'll be great because these cases where there's not enough where we want to do an hour and a half episode, we can keep people updated on them and write a paragraph here and there on the newsletter. Also, I would invite other people if they want to write a couple paragraphs about a case and have it on our newsletter. So I think that's going to be a great way to bring our community together and share more of this information about stories that we're not going to do an episode on necessarily, or that we've already done an episode on and we just want to kind of do updates. So I'm really excited about that.
Yes.
Okay, so one more case suggestion from Amanda. Amanda says, I was born and raised in Springfield, Missouri. I live on the side of town where the initial incident occurred, the kidnapping. This happened February 9th, 2014. I was home that early evening. I'll never forget sitting quietly in my home computer when I started to hear police sirens, then more sirens, then more sirens. The sound of police sirens literally lasted for 5 straight minutes. I got up and walked out on my front porch because it was so bizarre that so many cops at once had lights and sirens on, speeding down one main road. Later that evening, I'm on Facebook and I see the Amber Alert, and I make the connection to all the sirens I'd heard earlier. This story goes from Amber Alert to found and murdered in the span of one evening.
And I didn't put the little girl's name down.
Okay, because I'm wondering.
You're looking for that, aren't you?
Well, it just seems like it cut off right there.
This was a little 10-year-old girl who was abducted by a 50-year-old pedophile or something who raped and murdered her and disposed of her body.
Oh.
When Amanda says it went from Amber Alert to found and murdered in the span of one evening, a couple out walking or something, driving around, whatever, saw the abduction. So the wife wrote down the license number of the vehicle, and the husband followed them.
Wow.
But they lost him. So,
shit.
So they couldn't find the person, but they got the license number, and they got this guy. Boom.
But too late
to save her. Too late to save the little girl.
That's heartbreaking.
Yes.
So this was recent? This was 2014. Yeah, not that long ago.
Not too long ago.
Wow. Well, that's horrible. I guess that's something that Amanda will never forget.
No, Amanda gave us 3 links, which I neglected to put into the note, but I've saved her email. So I've got some links to it if we want to get into that more.
Well, like I said, with the newsletter, we'll be able to get into all of these a little bit. So I think that'll be nice.
All right.
I know you're looking at me like that's going to be more work, but that's okay.
That's okay.
All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening again, and we will see you next time at the quiet end. Bye-bye. All right.
Goodbye.